Chapter 27. Directive number 17. As planning for the invasion of England progressed, Hitler issued a new directive, number 17, which called for an all-out assault on the RAF. The German Air Force is to overpower the English Air Force with all the forces at its command in the shortest possible time, Hitler wrote. The attacks are to be directed primarily against flying units, their ground installations and their supply organizations, but also against the aircraft industry, including that manufacturing anti-aircraft equipment. Hitler reserved to himself the right to decide on terror attacks as measures of reprisal. His continued reluctance to authorize raids against central London and the civilian districts of other big cities had nothing to do with moral distaste, but rather stemmed from his continued hope for a peace deal with Churchill, and a wish to avoid reprisal raids on Berlin. This new campaign against the RAF was a milestone in the history of warfare, according to the Luftwaffe's own later assessment. For the first time, an Air Force was going to conduct, independent of operations by other services, an offensive which aimed at decisively smashing the enemy Air Force. The question was, could air power alone undermine the general fighting power of the enemy by massed air attacks until he is ready to sue for peace? The task of planning and executing this new strategic bombing offensive fell to Hermann Göring, who codenamed the launch date Adlertag, or Eagle Day. He set it first for August 5th, then pushed it back to August 10th, a Saturday. He had absolute confidence that his Air Force would fulfill Hitler's wish. On Tuesday, August 6th, he met with his senior air commanders at his country estate, Kallinghal, to fashion a plan for the new campaign. Until now, the Luftwaffe had engaged in limited operations against England, intended to probe its air defences and draw out RAF fighters. German bombers conducted short, isolated raids against communities in Cornwall, Devon, South Wales and elsewhere. But now, Göring, given as always to flamboyant gestures, envisioned a mass attack, unlike anything history had seen, aimed at delivering an annihilating blow to Britain's air defences. He expected little resistance. According to reports by his intelligence chief, Beppo Schmidt, the RAF had already been badly mauled, and could not possibly produce enough new aircraft to compensate for its losses. This meant the RAF's strength was decreasing by the day. In Schmidt's appraisal, soon the RAF would have no serviceable aircraft at all. Goaded by Göring and fortified by Schmidt's reports, the Air Force commanders gathered at Kallinghal decided they would need only 4 days to destroy what remained of the RAF's fighter and bomber operations. After this, the Luftwaffe would proceed, step by step, in day and night raids, to eliminate airbases and aircraft manufacturing centres throughout England. A bold plan, with one very large, indeterminate and crucial variable. Weather. Göring transferred hundreds of bombers to bases along the Channel coast of France and in Norway. He planned an initial attack involving 1,500 aircraft, a modern armada meant to surprise and overwhelm the British. Once airborne, Göring's bombers would need only 6 minutes to cross the Channel. What Beppo Schmidt's reports depicted, however, was very different from what Luftwaffe pilots were experiencing in the air. Göring refused to listen to his fighter commander's protests that such claims were not realistic, Luftwaffe ace Gallant later told an American interrogator. In encounters with the RAF, German pilots found no hint of diminished strength or resolve. The big attack was to begin that coming Saturday. If all went well, invasion would soon follow. Chapter 28. O Moon, Lovely Moon. One of the most distinctive aspects of Churchill's approach to leadership was his ability to switch tracks in an instant and focus earnestly on things that any other Prime Minister would have found trivial. Depending on one's perspective, this was either an endearing trait or a bedevilment. To Churchill, everything mattered. On Friday, August 9th, for example, amid a rising tide of urgent war matters, he found time to address a minute to the members of his war cabinet on a subject dear to him, the length and writing style of the reports that arrived in his black box each day. Headed, appropriately enough, by the succinct title, Brevity, the minute began,
To do our work, we all have to read a mass of papers. Nearly all of them are far too long. This wastes time, while energy has to be spent in looking for the essential points. He set out four ways for his ministers and their staffs to improve their reports. First, he wrote, reports should set out the main points in a series of short, crisp paragraphs. If the report involved discussion of complicated matters or statistical analysis, this should be placed in an appendix. Often, he observed, a full report could be dispensed with entirely in favour of an aide-mémoire, consisting of headings only, which can be expanded orally if needed. Finally, he attacked the cumbersome prose that so often marked official reports. Let us have an end to phrases such as these, he wrote, and quoted two offenders. It is also of importance to bear in mind the following considerations. Consideration should be given to the possibility of carrying into effect. He wrote, most of these woolly phrases are mere padding, which can be left out altogether or replaced by a single word. Let us not shrink from using the short expressive phrase, even if it is conversational. The resulting prose, he wrote, may at first seem rough as compared with the flat surface of officialese jargon, but the saving of time will be great, while the discipline of setting out the real points concisely will prove an aid to clear thinking. That evening, as he had done almost every weekend thus far, he set off for the country. The private secretary on Checker's duty that weekend was John Colville, who rode in a separate car with Clementine and Mary. Other guests had already gathered at the house, or soon would, including Anthony Eden, Pug, and two key generals, who all converged to dine and sleep. Churchill also invited First Sea Lord Dudley Pound, but failed to tell anyone else, which, as Colville noted, occasioned some hectic rearranging of the dinner table. After the meal, Mary and Clementine left the dining room, as per custom and Clementine's preference. Among the men, the talk turned to the threat of invasion and to measures taken to defend England. Anti-tank mines had been secreted along many of the country's beaches, and these, wrote Colville, had been shown to be most devastating. Indeed, he noted, they had claimed the lives of a number of English citizens. Churchill told the story, possibly apocryphal, of an ill-starred golfer who managed to direct a golf ball onto an adjacent beach. Colville summarized the denouement in his diary. He took his niblick down to the beach, played the ball, and all that remained afterward was the ball, which returned safely to the green. After dinner, Churchill, the generals, and Admiral Pound moved to the hortry room, where large timbers had been installed to brace the structure against explosion. Within the room were innumerable treasures, among them a book dating to 1476. Meanwhile, Colville read memoranda and arranged the papers in Churchill's black box. At one point, a German aircraft flew overhead. With Churchill in the lead, the group charged out into the garden to try to catch a glimpse of the plane. To the amusement of all, Admiral Pound tripped while descending the steps. Wrote Colville, the First Sea Lord fell down first one flight of steps, and then, having picked himself up disconsolately, he tumbled down another, ending in a heap on the ground where a sentry threatened him with a bayonet. Pound righted himself, muttering, this is not the place for a First Sea Lord. Churchill, amused, said, try and remember you are an admiral of the fleet and not a midshipman. Saturday morning brought more work for Colville in the form of cables to send and minutes to relay. He then had lunch en famille with Churchill, Clementine and Mary, and it could not have been more enjoyable. Churchill was in the best of humours, Colville wrote. He talked brilliantly on every topic, from Ruskin to Lord Baldwin, from the future of Europe to the strength of the Tory party. He complained about the dire lack of munitions and weapons for the army he was trying to build. We shall win, he declared, but we don't deserve it. At least we do deserve it because of our virtues, but not because of our intelligence. The talk turned silly. Colville began reciting bits of doggerel. One quatrain gave Churchill particular delight. O moon, lovely moon, with thy beautiful face, careering throughout the boundaries of space, whenever I see thee, I think in my mind, shall I ever, O ever, behold thy behind. After lunch, Colville, Clementine and Mary climbed one of the adjacent hills. Colville and Mary turned the walk into a race to see who could reach the top first. Colville won, but ended up feeling iller than I have ever felt and was quite unable to see or think. Mary's appraisal of Colville was steadily improving, though she still had reservations. In her diary for Saturday, August 10th, she wrote, "I like Jock, but I think he is very wet." Wet being a British colloquial term for appearing to lack character or forcefulness. For his part, Colville continued warming to Mary as well. In his diary the next day, he wrote, "Even though she takes herself a little seriously, as she confesses, she is a charming girl and very pleasant to look upon." For Hermann Göring that Saturday, there was disappointment. This was the day he had designated as Eagle Day, the start of his all-out campaign against the RAF. But bad weather over the south of England forced him to cancel the attack. He set the new start for the next morning, Sunday, August 11th, but then postponed it again to Tuesday, August 13th. One consolation. With the moon, by then well into its waxing gibbous phase, rising toward a full moon the coming weekend, those sorties designated to take place at night would be easier and more successful. Germany's beam navigation technology had reduced the Luftwaffe's dependence on moonlight, but its pilots remained wary of the new system and still preferred attacking in clear weather over a landscape agleam with lunar light. In Berlin, workers continued building grandstands in Pariser Platz, at the center of the city, to prepare for the victory parade that would mark the end of the war. "Today they painted them and installed two huge golden eagles," wrote William Shire in his diary entry for Sunday. "At each end they also are building gigantic replicas of the Iron Cross." His hotel was on the same square, at one end of which stood the Brandenburger Tor, the Brandenburg Gate, through which the victorious army was to pass. Within Nazi party circles, Shire found, there was talk that Hitler wanted the stands ready before the end of the month. Part 3. Dread. August to September. Chapter 29. Eagle Day. At dawn on Tuesday, August 13th, two groups of German bombers, totaling about 60 aircraft, rose into the skies over Amiens, France, climbing in broad ascending circles to flight altitude, where they assembled in battle formations. This took half an hour. Getting so many planes into position was difficult even on clear days, but this morning the challenge was compounded by an unexpected change in the weather. A high-pressure zone over the Azores that had seemed poised to deliver fair weather in Europe had abruptly dissipated. Now heavy clouds covered the channel and the coasts of France and England, and fog clung to many German airfields. Over England's southeastern coast, the ceiling was as low as 4,000 feet. A third group of aircraft, with 100 bombers, rose over Dieppe. A fourth, with 40 planes, assembled north of Cherbourg. A fifth gathered over the Channel Islands. Once in formation, numbering well over 200 bombers, the planes began making their way toward England. This was to be Hermann Göring's big day, Adlertag, Eagle Day, the start of his all-out assault on the RAF to gain control of the air over England so that Hitler could launch his invasion. Over the previous week, the Luftwaffe had launched lesser attacks, including forays against England's chain of coastal radar stations, but it was time now for the main event. Göring planned to blacken the sky with aircraft in a display of aerial might that would stun the world. For this purpose, and for the sake of drama, he had amassed a force totaling 2,300 aircraft, including 949 bombers, 336 dive bombers, and 1,002 fighters. At last, he would show Hitler and the world what his air force truly could do. No sooner did the attack begin, however, than the weather forced Göring to call it off. Although the Luftwaffe's secret navigational beams now permitted its bombers to fly in overcast weather, a raid of this size and importance required good visibility. Fighters and bombers could not find each other in clouds, nor could they communicate directly with one another, and fighters lacked the equipment needed to follow the beams. The cancellation order failed to reach many of Göring's units. In one case, a formation of 80 bombers set out for England, while their designated escorts, which did receive the order, returned to base, leaving the bombers dangerously exposed. The commander continued onward, apparently in the belief that the overcast skies would limit the RAF's ability to find his force in the first place. As one group approached its target, a swarm of RAF Hurricanes appeared, their arrival so unexpected, their attack so furious, that the bombers dropped their munitions and fled into the clouds. Goering gave orders to resume the offensive at 2 o'clock that afternoon. Among the pilots taking part was Adolf Galland, who by now held a near-mythic reputation not only within the Luftwaffe, but also among RAF pilots. Like Churchill, his signature was the cigar. He smoked Havanas, 20 a day, which he lit using a cigar lighter scavenged from a car, and was the only pilot authorized by Goering to smoke while in the cockpit. Hitler, however, forbade him from being photographed while he smoked, fearing the influence such publicity might have on the morals of German youths. Galland and his group were now based at a field in Pas-de-Calais, on the French coast. For the Luftwaffe, accustomed to the easy victories of the early phase of the war, this period was, Galland said, a rude awakening. The 90-minute flying time of his group's ME-109 fighters was proving an even greater liability than usual, given the half-hour needed to assemble formations of bombers and escorts over the French coast before heading to England. Galland's fighters had an operational range of only 125 miles, or roughly the distance to London. "Everything beyond was practically out of reach," he wrote. He likened German fighters to a dog on a chain, who wants to attack the foe but cannot harm him because of the limitation of his chain. The Luftwaffe also was fast discovering the limitations of its Stuka dive bomber, which had been one of its most potent weapons in the Western campaign of May and June. It could place a bomb with far more precision than a standard aircraft, but owing in part to its external bomb load, it flew at about half the speed of a Spitfire. It was most vulnerable while diving, a trait British pilots quickly exploited. Wrote Galland, "These Stukas attracted Spitfires and Hurricanes as honey attracts flies." Germany's larger bombers also flew at relatively slow speeds. In Spain and Poland, those speeds were fast enough to avoid effective interception, but not now, against the latest British fighters. The bombers needed a big protective escort. How this could be provided was a growing source of conflict between the fighter pilots and Goering, who insisted that the fighters fly close escort, staying level with and close to the bombers all the way to their targets and back. This meant the pilots had to fly at the bombers' much slower speeds, not only making themselves more vulnerable to attack, but also limiting their opportunities to accumulate kills, which was all any fighter pilot really wanted. One pilot recalled the frustration of looking up and seeing the bright blue bellies of British fighters and not being allowed to go after them. "We clung to the bomber formation in pairs, and it was a damned awkward feeling," he wrote. Galland favoured looser patterns that allowed fighter pilots to fly their planes as they were meant to be flown, with some flying slow and close, but others weaving among the bombers at high speeds, while still more flew high above the bomber formation, providing top cover. But Goering refused to listen. Galland and his fellow pilots increasingly saw him as being out of touch with the new realities of aerial combat. Although popular perception, influenced by Goering's self-promotion, portrayed the Luftwaffe as a nearly invincible force with a might far greater than the RAF's, in fact, Galland recognized that the British had several major advantages that he and his fellow pilots could do nothing to neutralize. Not only did the RAF fly and fight over friendly territory, which ensured that surviving pilots would fight again, its pilots also fought with the existential brio of men who believed they were battling a far larger air force, with nothing less than Britain's survival at stake. RAF pilots recognized the desperate seriousness of the situation, as Galland put it, while the Luftwaffe operated with a degree of complacency, conjured by easy past successes and by faulty intelligence that portrayed the RAF as a desperately weakened force. German analysts accepted, without challenge, reports from Luftwaffe pilots of downed British aircraft and crippled airfields. In fact, the bases often resumed operation within hours. At Luftwaffe HQ, however, somebody took the reports of the bomber or Stuka squadron in one hand and a thick blue pencil in the other and crossed the squadron or base in question off the tactical map, Galland wrote, It did not exist anymore. In any case, not on paper. The RAF's greatest advantage, Gallant believed, was its deft use of radar. Germany possessed similar technology, but thus far had not deployed it in a systematic manner, in the belief that British bombers would never be able to reach German cities. The possibility of an Allied air attack on the Reich was, at the time, unthinkable, Gallant wrote. German pilots saw the tall radar towers along England's coastline as they crossed the Channel and occasionally attacked them, but the stations invariably returned to operation soon afterward, and Göring lost interest. Yet, day after day, Gallant was struck by the uncanny ability of British fighters to locate German formations. For us, and for our command, this was a surprise and a very bitter one, Gallant wrote. Göring himself was proving to be a problem. Easily distracted, he was unable to commit to a single well-defined objective. He became convinced that by attacking a multitude of targets across a broad front, he could not only destroy RAF Fighter Command, but also cause such widespread chaos as to drive Churchill to surrender. The attack resumed. As Eagle Day progressed, nearly 500 bombers and 1,000 fighters entered the skies over England. In the aerial parlance of the day, this was called landfall. Chapter 30. Perplexity. Once again, England's chain home radar network detected the approach of German aircraft, but this time the number of bombers and fighters exceeded anything the radar operators had seen before. At about 3:30 p.m., they identified three formations of German aircraft with some 30 bombers, each crossing the Channel from bases in Normandy. Then came two more formations, totaling roughly 60 aircraft. RAF sector commanders ordered their fighter squadrons into the air. At about 4 p.m., more than 100 RAF fighters were airborne and racing toward the attackers, guided by ground controllers using location information provided by the radar stations and by ground observers, who began reporting the types of approaching aircraft and their altitude, speed, and location. A massive formation of German fighters flew well ahead of the approaching bombers. Both forces met in a tumult of roaring engines and chattering machine guns, manoeuvring wildly through a scree of heavy-caliber bullets and cannon fire. The bombers continued forward. Bombs fell on Southampton and a range of other locales in Dorset, Hampshire, Wiltshire, Canterbury, and Castle Bromwich. British observers were mystified. Bombs fell everywhere, on airfields, harbours, and ships, but with no clear pattern or focus. And strangely, the bombers left London untouched, a surprise, since the Germans had shown no such reticence in their attack on Rotterdam. By late afternoon, the fighting in the skies over Britain had reached an intensity not previously experienced. Wave after wave of German bombers and fighters were met by RAF Hurricanes and Spitfires, flying 700 distinct sorties guided by radar. The Air Ministry reported that the RAF destroyed 78 German bombers, at a cost of 3 of its own pilots. At 10 Downing, there was jubilation. But there was unease, too. The intensity of the day's raids seemed to signal an increase in the size and violence of Germany's aerial attacks. What the RAF did not yet understand was that this was the start of a major German offensive, the beginning of what later became known as the Battle of Britain, though that phrase would enter common usage only early the next year, with publication by the Air Ministry of a 32-page, thusly titled pamphlet that sought to capture the drama of the campaign and sold a million copies. But on Tuesday, August 13th, 1940, none of this was clear. For now, the day's raids merely seemed to be the latest episode in an intensifying and perplexing pattern of aerial attack. The question everyone is asking today is, what is the motive of these gigantic daylight raids, which cost so much and effect so little, wrote John Colville in his diary. Are they reconnaissance in force? Or a diversion? Or just the cavalry attack before the main offensive? Presumably, the next few days will show. As it happened, the day's score proved to be exaggerated, a common problem in the immediate aftermath of battle, but the ratio still seemed propitious. The Luftwaffe lost 45 planes in all, the RAF 13, for a ratio of over 3 to 1. In Washington that day, Roosevelt met with key members of his cabinet and told them he had reached a decision on how he would transfer the 50 aging destroyers to England. He would use his executive powers to authorize the ships for bases deal without seeking congressional approval. Moreover, he would not tell Congress about it until the deal became final. Roosevelt informed Churchill of his plan in a telegram that reached London that night. Churchill was delighted, but now he had to find a way to make the deal palatable to his own government and to the House of Commons, where the idea of leasing the islands, sovereign territory, aroused deep feelings. Churchill understood that if the issue were presented to the British as a naked trading away of British possessions for the sake of 50 destroyers, it would certainly encounter vehement opposition. He urged Roosevelt not to announce it to the public as a this-for-that exchange, but rather to frame the destroyer transfer and the leases as completely separate agreements. "Our view is that we are two friends in danger, helping each other as far as we can," he cabled Roosevelt. The gift of the destroyers would be, he wrote, entirely a separate, spontaneous act. Churchill feared that casting the deal as a commercial transaction might cause him grave political harm, for it clearly favoured America, in that it provided 99-year leases of British territory, while the U.S. Navy was handing over a flotilla of obsolete ships that Congress had once wanted to scrap. To frame it publicly as a contract, with the destroyers as payment for territory, would inevitably raise questions about which party had gotten the better deal, and it would quickly become clear that America had come out much the winner. But Roosevelt had worries of his own. His decision carried with it the potential to derail his campaign to win a third term as president, especially at a time when the conscription bill in Congress was already inflaming passions on both sides of the aisle. To give a gift of 50 destroyers spontaneously would constitute a clear violation of neutrality laws and stretch the bounds of executive authority. It was crucial for the American public to recognize not only that the deal had resulted from some hard and savvy bargaining, but also that it increased the security of the United States. As to security, there was little debate, provided the agreement itself did not drag America into the war. The transfer to Great Britain of 50 American warships was a decidedly unneutral act by the United States. Churchill wrote later, "It would, according to all the standards of history, have justified the German government in declaring war upon them." The next day, Wednesday, August 14th, was supposed to be the second day of Göring's promised four-day drive to destroy the RAF. But once again, he was thwarted by the weather, which was even worse than the day before, and kept most of his planes on the ground. Nonetheless, some bomber groups managed to carry out sorties against targets scattered throughout western England. Adolf Gallant was delighted to receive orders to fly detached escort for a formation of 80 Stuka dive bombers. His was one of an equal number of fighters assigned to protect the bombers, of which about half would fly well ahead, like Gallant, while the rest stayed close to the formation. As Gallant and his wingman walked to their ME-109s, Gallant said he could tell it was going to be a good day, what he called a hunter's day. The bombers were to approach England over the Strait of Dover, the narrowest point in the channel. To Gallant, this meant he and his squadron would have plenty of time for combat before their fuel limits drove them back across the channel. That the RAF would make an appearance seemed to Gallant beyond question, and in fact, British radar in Dover detected him and his group even as they massed over France. Four squadrons of RAF fighters rose to meet them. Gallant saw them in the distance, well before his plane passed over the famous chalk cliffs at Dover. Gallant drove headlong into the phalanx of fighters and picked out an RAF Hurricane, off by itself. But the pilot was too quick. He rolled his plane, then plunged in a fast dive toward the sea, pulling up only at the last second. Gallant chose not to follow. Instead, he gunned his engine and climbed 1,000 feet in order to get a better look at the unfolding fight. He rolled his plane 360 degrees to give him a full view, his trademark maneuver. He spotted a Hurricane fighter that was clearly about to attack one of the Stuka bombers, which was lumbering along at a pace that made it an easy target. Gallant fired at long range. The Hurricane bolted into a cloud. Acting on a hunch, Gallant positioned himself near where he guessed the British plane would emerge, and an instant later the Hurricane popped from the cloud right in front of him. Gallant fired, blasting away for 3 full seconds, a minor eternity in a dogfight. The Hurricane spiraled to the ground. Gallant returned safely to France. In the course of the second day of air battles, the Luftwaffe lost 19 aircraft, the RAF 8. Göring was very unhappy. Chapter 31. Göring. The weather continued to disrupt Göring's grand plan for the annihilation of the RAF, grounding most of his aircraft. On Thursday, August 15th, the day his bombers and fighters should have nearly completed the campaign, he used the lull to summon his top officers to his country estate, Karinhal, and reproached them for their lackluster performance thus far. Late that morning, however, as his inquisition progressed, the weather suddenly improved, yielding clear skies, prompting his field commanders to launch a colossal attack involving more than 2,100 aircraft. Forever after, within the Luftwaffe, the day would be known as Black Thursday. One incident seemed emblematic. The Luftwaffe believed that with so many German aircraft approaching from the south, the RAF would dispatch as many fighters as possible to England's southern coast to defend against the coming onslaught, including fighters that were usually based in northern England, thereby leaving the north unprotected. This presumption, coupled with intelligence that described the RAF as a severely eroded force, prompted one Luftwaffe commander to order a raid against RAF bases in northern England, using bombers from Norway. Ordinarily, a raid like this, in daylight, would have been foolhardy, since Germany's best fighters, the ME-109s, did not have the range to escort the bombers all the way across the North Sea. The mission was a gamble, but, given the underlying assumptions, seemed tactically sound. So it was that, at 12:30 that afternoon, a force of 63 German bombers approached England's northeast coast, escorted by a skimpy force of 2-man, twin-engine fighters, the only kind capable of flying so long a distance, but far less agile than the single-engine ME-109, and thus more vulnerable to attack. The RAF, however, did not behave as expected. While Fighter Command had indeed concentrated its forces in the south, it had kept some northern squadrons in place to defend against precisely this kind of strike. The German bombers were about 25 miles offshore when the first Spitfires arrived, flying 3,000 feet above the formation. As one RAF pilot looked down, he saw the bombers silhouetted against gleaming white cloud tops, and exclaimed through his radio, "There's more than 100 of them!" The Spitfires dove through the formation, blasting away with terrifying effect. The bombers scattered, seeking shelter in the clouds 600 feet below. They jettisoned their cargoes, scattering bombs over the coastal countryside, and turned back, never having reached their targets. In this one encounter, the Luftwaffe lost 15 aircraft, the RAF, none. And this was just one of thousands of aerial battles that took place that Thursday alone, the Luftwaffe flying 1,800 sorties, the RAF, 1,000. It proved to be the last day of life for a young Luftwaffe lieutenant who piloted one of the twin-engine ME-110s. The second seat was occupied by a wireless telegraph operator, who also manned a machine gun. RAF intelligence recovered the pilot's diary, which told worlds about the harrowing life of German aircrews. His very first war flight had taken place the previous month, on July 18th, during which he had fired 2,000 rounds of machine gun ammunition and his plane had been hit by opposing fire 3 times. 4 days later, he learned that his best friend, a fellow airman, had been killed. "I have known him since he was 11, and his death shook me considerably." A week after this, his own fighter got hit 30 times, and his wireless operator was nearly killed. "He has got a wound as big as my fist because bits of the machine were driven in by the bullet," the pilot wrote. Over the next couple of weeks, more of his friends died, one killed when the control column of his ME-109 broke off as he tried to pull out of a dive. RAF intelligence provided the last entry in the young pilot's diary, on Thursday, August 15th, for him, indeed, the blackest of Thursdays, just 28 days after his first combat flight. A notation reads, "The writer of this diary was killed in S9 plus TH. The code was the Luftwaffe's identifier for the pilot's aircraft." Chapter 32. The Bomber in the Pasture. Throughout Thursday, John Colville found himself once again called upon to deliver the latest count of downed aircraft. The tally of successes seemed incredible. The RAF claimed its fighter shot down 182 German aircraft for certain, and possibly another 53. Churchill, caught up in the excitement, commandeered Pug Ismay for a visit to the RAF operations room at Uxbridge, which directed fighters attached to No. 11 Group, charged with defending London and southeast England. In the car afterward, he admonished Pug, "Don't speak to me. I have never been so moved." After a few minutes, Churchill broke the silence, saying, "Never in the field of human conflict has so much been owed by so many to so few." The remark had such power that Ismay quoted it to his wife after returning home. He had no idea that Churchill would soon deploy the line in one of his most famous speeches. In reality, once again, the day score was not quite as brilliant as Churchill had been told. The Luftwaffe lost 75 aircraft. The RAF, 34. The original numbers, however, had been so widely reported and lauded that they became fixed in the popular imagination. RAF exploits continued to arouse intense satisfaction, Home Intelligence proclaimed. Alexander Cadogan, Foreign Affairs Undersecretary, wrote in his diary, "This was to be the day Hitler was to be in London. Can't find him." The focus on keeping score masked a graver reality, however, as the prof, ever ready to dampen any inclination toward ecstasy, made clear in his relentless, unflinching production of histograms, stacked area charts, and Venn diagrams, some quite beautiful, with proportions represented in crimson and lovely shades of green and blue. The prof reminded everyone concerned that the much-touted tallies of losses in the air did not include the number of British aircraft destroyed on the ground. On Friday, August 16th, the Luftwaffe attacked the important RAF base at Tangmere, 5 miles inland from the Channel, and destroyed or crippled 14 aircraft, including 6 bombers and 7 first-line fighters. Later that day, a German raid on an RAF base west of Oxford destroyed 46 planes used for flight training. The score also omitted British bombers shot down or damaged during raids over Germany. On Friday night, August 16th, for example, RAF Bomber Command dispatched 150 bombers and lost 7. At Chequers the next day, with the prof in attendance, Churchill composed a minute to Chief of the Air Staff Sir Cyril Newell. "While our eyes are concentrated on the results of the air fighting over this country," he wrote, "we must not overlook the serious losses occurring in the Bomber Command." These casualties, combined with the number of aircraft destroyed on the ground and the tally of fighters lost in combat, added up to a rather different ratio of British and German losses. "In fact, on the day, we have lost 2 to 3, Churchill wrote. It was only now that British air officials began to realize that something new was occurring and that the RAF itself was the target. Over the preceding week, air intelligence had noted only a general increase in activity by the German Air Force. Bad weather and the seemingly random selection of targets had masked the all-out nature of the campaign. But now the awareness grew that this was indeed different, and that it might well be a preamble to the expected invasion of England. A British intelligence report for the week ended August 22nd noted that 50 RAF fields had been attacked in raids involving an average of 700 aircraft a day. The report warned that if Germany succeeded in hobbling these defences, an intense bombing campaign was likely to follow, conducted by Germany's long-range bombing force, which would then be free to operate by day without serious opposition. For the public, too, this perception of increasing ferocity was slow to crystallize. Memories of the previous war, with its grotesque land battles, were still fresh in the British psyche, and this new war in the sky bore little comparison. If the battles occurred at low altitude, people on the ground might hear machine guns and engines. If at high altitude, they heard and saw almost nothing. Clouds often masked the action overhead. On clear days,
contrails etched spirals and loops against the sky. On one sunny day in August, journalist Virginia Coles found herself watching a major air battle while lying on the grass atop Shakespeare Cliff near Dover. "The setting was majestic," she wrote. "In front of you stretched the blue water of the Channel, and in the distance you could distinguish the hazy outline of the coast of France. Houses lay below. Boats and trawlers drifted in the harbour, agleam with sun. The water sparkled. Above hung 20 or more immense grey barrage balloons, like airborne manatees. Meanwhile, high above, pilots fought to the death. You lay in the tall grass, with the wind blowing gently across you, and watched the hundreds of silver planes swarming through the heavens like clouds of gnats," she wrote. "All around you, anti-aircraft guns were shuddering and coughing, stabbing the sky with small white bursts. Flaming planes arced toward the ground, leaving as their last testament a long black smudge against the sky." She heard engines and machine guns. "You knew the fate of civilization was being decided 15,000 feet above your head in a world of sun, wind, and sky," she wrote. "You knew it, but even so it was hard to take it in." Now and then an onlooker might catch sight of a British pilot still in flight gear, hailing a cab for the ride back to his airfield. For parachutists who survived the descent, there was another danger: trigger-happy members of the Home Guard. The danger was particularly acute for German airmen. One Luftwaffe bomber pilot, Rudolf Lamberti, had a singularly vivid encounter with British defenders, both in the air and on the ground. First, his bomber collided with a cable shot into the sky by a rocket and suspended there from a small parachute. Climbing to escape further entanglement, he was hit by anti-aircraft fire, then machine-gunned by British fighters, before finally crash-landing amid a hail of Home Guard bullets. Taken prisoner, he found himself dodging bombs dropped by his own side. He survived. 7 of the 9 bombers assigned to his squadron failed to return to base. The thousands of battles fought by the RAF and the Luftwaffe filled the skies with bits of metal, machine gun bullets, anti-aircraft shrapnel, fragments of aircraft, all of which had to go somewhere. Remarkably, most of it ended up falling harmlessly into fields, forests, or the sea, but not always, as became chillingly clear to Harold Nicholson's wife, Vita Sackville-West. In a letter to her husband, sent from their country home, Sissinghurst, she told him she had found a heavy caliber bullet that had passed through the roof of their garden shed. "So you see," she scolded, "I am right to tell you to keep indoors when they fight just overhead. They are nasty, pointed things." Among residents of London, there was a mounting sense that the air raids were coming closer to the city, that something big was about to occur. On Friday, August 16th, bombs fell on the outer borough of Croydon, killing or badly wounding 80 people and damaging 2 of Lord Beaverbrook's factories. That same day, bombers struck Wimbledon, killing 14 civilians and wounding 59. Londoners were on edge. In the city, warning sirens became commonplace. The Ministry of Information stated in its Friday intelligence report that residents were beginning to shed their conviction that Germany would never dare bomb the city. An unpleasant aspect of the tension, wrote mass observation diarist Olivia Cockett, was that one thinks every noise now will be a siren or plane. At the slightest sound, everyone adopted that listening look. Moonlight was a particular source of dread. That Friday, August 16th, Cockett wrote in her diary, "With this gorgeous moon, we all expect more tonight." This did not keep John Colville from setting out that evening for a weekend in the country and a much-needed break from the exhausting demands of Churchill. A red alert was still in effect as he left 10 Downing Street and began the 2-hour drive to Stansted Park in West Sussex, near Portsmouth. He was headed for the estate of Vere Ponsonby, 9th Earl of Bessborough, whose daughter, Moira, and son Eric were friends of his. Here stood Stansted House, a comely 3-story Edwardian box of red ochre brick, fronted by a portico of 6 Ionic columns. The estate was historically noteworthy for the fact that, in 1651, King Charles II had passed through its grounds while making his escape after his army had been crushed by Cromwell in the last big battle of the English Civil War. The nearby city of Portsmouth, an important naval base, had of late become a favourite target of the Luftwaffe.
Situated on the Solent, the boomerang-shaped strait separating England's southern coast from the Isle of Wight, the base was the home port for destroyer flotillas, charged with protecting merchant shipping and defending England against invasion. An RAF airfield occupied nearby Thorny Island, separated from the mainland by a narrow channel, eerily named the Great Deep. When Colville arrived, he found only Lord Bessborough's wife, Roberta, and daughter Moira at home, Eric being away with his regiment, and Bessborough himself delayed by a bomb on the railway over which his train was to pass. Colville, Moira, and Lady Bessborough dined by themselves, tended by servants. Colville joked that his main reason for coming was to see one of these great air battles. He awoke the next morning, Saturday, August 17th, to a hot and sunny day, devoid of aerial activity. He and Moira took a walk in one of the estate's gardens to gather peaches, then continued on until they came to the wreckage of a German bomber, a twin-engine Junkers Ju-88, one of the mainstays of the Luftwaffe, easily recognized in the air by its bulbous cockpit set forward of the wings, which gave it the look of a very large dragonfly. A torn and twisted portion of the aircraft had come to rest in a pasture, upside down, exposing the underside of a wing and one wheel of its landing gear. For Colville, this was an odd moment. It was one thing to experience the war at a ministerial remove, quite another to see first-hand evidence of its violence and cost. Here was a German bomber lying in countryside as classically English as any traveller could imagine, an undulating topography of meadow, forest and farmland that sloped gently toward the south, with vestiges of medieval forest once used for hunting and the harvest of timber. Exactly how the bomber came to be here, Colville could not have said, but here it was, an alien mechanical presence, its body dark green, its underwing grey, splashed here and there with yellow and blue insignia, like random flowers. A white starfish gleamed from the centre of a blue shield. Once a terrifying symbol of modern warfare, the bomber lay emasculated in a field, a mere relic to view before returning home for tea. As it happened, the plane had been shot down 6 days earlier, at 12:15 p.m., a mere 45 minutes after leaving its airfield outside Paris. An RAF fighter intercepted it at 9,000 feet, killing its radio man and striking an engine, causing the aircraft to enter a spin. As the bomber's pilot fought to regain control, the plane broke apart, with its tail and rear gun assembly tumbling onto Thorny Island, the tail portion landing just outside the airfield's operations room. The bulk of the bomber, the portion seen by Colville and Moira, landed at Horse Pasture Farm, at the edge of Stansted's parklands. In all, three of the crew, aged 21 to 28, were killed, the youngest just 2 weeks shy of his birthday. A fourth crewman, though wounded, managed to parachute to a safe landing and was taken prisoner. In the course of the war, Stansted became something of a magnet for bombs and fallen aircraft, with a total of 85 bombs and 4 planes landing on its grounds. The rest of Saturday unfolded without event, but the next day, as Colville put it, I got my wish. Colville awoke to another perfect summer day, just as warm and sunny as the one before. Throughout the morning, air raid sirens warned of attack, but none came, and no aircraft appeared in the skies overhead. After lunch, however, this changed. Colville and Moira were seated on the south-facing terrace of the house, which offered a distant view of the Solent and Thorny Island. To the right, woodlands occupied the foreground, beyond which they could just see the barrage balloons meant to protect Portsmouth from low-altitude attack by dive bombers. Suddenly we heard the sound of anti-aircraft fire and saw puffs of white smoke as the shells burst over Portsmouth, Colville wrote. Anti-aircraft explosions pocked the sky. From off to the left came a crescendo of aircraft engines and machine gun fire, rising to a roar. There they are, Moira cried. Shading their eyes against the sun, they spotted 20 aircraft in heated combat, breathtakingly close, offering the two what Colville called a grandstand view. A German bomber arced from the sky, trailing a plume of smoke, then disappeared beyond the trees. A parachute opened, Colville wrote, and sank gracefully down through the whirling fighters and bombers. A dive bomber, probably a Stuka, broke loose, hovered like a bird of prey, and entered a steep dive in the direction of Thorny Island. Other dive bombers followed. Now came the far-off thunder of high explosives. Smoke blossomed from the island, where hangars appeared to have been set aflame. Four of the Portsmouth barrage balloons exploded and sagged from view. All this as Colville and Moira watched at a distance through the pretty August haze. They remained on the terrace, in high spirits, elated by what we had seen, Colville wrote. By his estimate, the battle lasted all of 2 minutes. Afterward, they played tennis. Chapter 33. Berlin. In Berlin on Saturday morning, Joseph Goebbels focused his regular propaganda meeting on how best to take advantage of what he believed must certainly be a rising sense of dread among England's civilian population. The important thing now, he told the gathering, is to intensify as far as possible the mood of panic which is undoubtedly slowly gaining ground in Britain. Germany's secret transmitters and foreign language service were to continue describing the frightful effects of air raids. The secret transmitters in particular should marshal witnesses who must give horrifying accounts of the destruction they have seen with their own eyes. This effort, he instructed, should also include transmissions warning listeners that fog and mist would not protect them from aerial attack. Bad weather merely confused the aim of German bombers and made it more likely that bombs would fall on unintended targets. Goebbels warned the heads of his foreign and domestic press departments to prepare for a drive by the British to use atrocity stories about the bombing deaths of old men and pregnant women to arouse the world's conscience. His press chiefs were to be ready to counter these claims at once, using pictures of children killed in a May 10, 1940 air raid on Freiburg, Germany. What he did not tell the meeting was that this raid, which killed 20 children on a playground, was carried out in error by German bombers, whose crews believed they were attacking the French city of Dijon. Hitler still would not allow bombers to attack London itself. The main goal was to put the English on edge, Goebbels said. We must continue to emphasize that even the present attacks are a mere foretaste of what is yet to come.